So when did you come into social work?
Well, I was qualified and started in 1959, but 1949, I'm just going to get these dates right. What happened was that how it started was one of those sort of odd things that I suppose happens enough. Margaret had just been in got the directorship of the Chichester Child Guidance Scheme. And I went down to Chichester with her because we were looking at a house we were going to buy there, which we did. And at that point, I was doing half-time work with the New Education Fellowship, getting their international book club going. New Education Fellowship.
Yes.
And they were running an international book club, and I was doing half-time work there, getting that going. And the other half time looking after Adrian when his mother was in Chichester.
Yes.
That was the sort of arrangement we had between us. And in the on the way back, Chichester in those days, they had three clinics. They had one at Horsham, one at Chichester, and one at Worthing. Mm. And on the train at Horsham, Lydia Jacob, as she was then, got on. She was one of Anna Freud's therapists, was working with Friedlander at Horsham. Mm. And we met in the buffet and were having a little cup of tea together, and she said, have you thought about doing psychosocial work? And I said, good Lord, no, never in my head. And I said, why? Well, she said, I think you should consider this seriously. And she knew my background. I'd been a mental nurse for quite a long time.
Oh, I see.
And I was at York Clinic, you know, and I don't know whether you know York Clinic, guys.
No.
Oh, well. Under the great R.D. Gillespie, it opened during the war to take serving officers from back from France just before the invasion. Of course, one didn't know there was going to be an invasion then. So they were all cases of psychological breakdown and illnesses. For instance, we had Admiral of the Fleet who went and jumped off the fifth floor, and that sort of thing we went through. And of course, no sooner had it opened then the flying bomb started.
Yes.
But the thing to that I was, had a flat, given a flat there, so that Margaret, we only had not been married, but that's a long story, we won't apply it, be appropriate here. But, so that we had this flat in York Clinic Guy's Hospital, and I had a very senior position there and so on. Anyway, that was the background, and also Margaret in Child Guidance, and that was why Lydia put it forward, quite seriously.
Yes.
So that I applied to the mental health course, and then even in those days there was always a back door left open for the odd person who hadn't got all the kind of qualifications that were considered necessary, like diplomas or degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But so that somebody like me can get in through the back door occasionally.
Yes.
And that's more. And I was seen, I had a long interview with Bowlby at this time.
Yes.
And anyway, I did the course. Well, in those days, this is 1948.
Yes.
Orby Lewis at the mortuary, he was responsible or made himself responsible for teaching psychiatric illnesses to the group of students at the mortuary then. And you probably have heard about Aubrey and so on. And I first met Aubrey when I was a student at the St. Francis Observation Ward, where he used to go once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always, and he often, I believe he used to have a poker at one time, but he didn't in my day. But
a poker club.
We used to point at the students. Yes.
Yeah, I see.
Oh yes, Orby was somebody, I tell you.
Mm.
But a marvellous teacher, and Kay and I still say that when we had a sort of proper psychiatric problem, well, now what would Orby have said? You know, because you know the sort of feeling he had.
Mm.
And Orby suddenly wheeled around and said to me, "Do you think there ought to be a magic?" This was in the days before the 1959 Act. There ought to be a magistrate involved in the certification of a patient. And I said, yes, I do. He said, you realize what you're saying, Mr. Myers, isn't it? That doctors are not infallible. I said, indeed I am. And, you know, we got on then very well, because people were so frightened of him, that, you know, they never had known him.
Yeah.
Well, then, I think a few weeks later, we were at the observation ward again, and the case was presented to him quite clearly, schizophrenia, I think, but he was also getting drunk a lot and things of this kind, and the young registrar was diagnosed as an alcoholic. And Audrey said to me, what do you think? I don't know why he asked me, but he did. And I said, no, I think this, surely this is a symptom of schizophrenia, which of course it was.
Yeah.
Well, it was out of that combination of circumstances that Audrey said to Elizabeth Howarth, I don't know whether you knew Elizabeth, did you?
Yes,
she died quite recently.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. She was at the Institute of Psychiatry as the person responsible for the teaching of students, PSW students there. And so Audrey said he wanted me at the Institute, and so I was appointed there.
Goodness, yes.
After I finished the course.
Yes.
Because there was a question of how many people there were around in those days. There weren't all that number. But I did half time, although I was employed by the Institute and paid by them, I was lent half time to hospital. So I did half time hospital work and half time Institute. And Orby wanted me to interest myself in the research into tics. Well, it really wasn't my line. And I mean, tics are very old, very well, but I wasn't very all that interested. But anyway, he insisted that I read sociology and various other things. He knew all about me, what I had done, what I hadn't done. And, by the way, before I came on the course, I'd done quite a lot of writing, and I'd been a music critical tribute and things like that.
I wanted to ask you about, if I may, before we get you know, too far into that.
Yes.
You started off as a psychiatric nurse, is that right?
Well, no, well, it didn't start work like that, but there was a point where, I put it this way, my mother had what wasn't diagnosed, and obviously it had when I was born, what was then called disseminated sclerosis, was called multiple sclerosis. And she died when I was eight or nine. So all my memories of her often finding her fallen down, and she was very fastidious, she was half French, fastidious woman, probably wet herself, you know, in a miserable state. And I never really got over it, and it was very, you know, just... And in fact, I think a lot of my interest in nursing was related back to this. Well, then my first real love affair, the girl finally got a malignant cerebral tumour, and she died. Well, by that time I was in a hell of a state, and I thought I would go to a leper colony in Africa. Well, sometime before that occurred, Crichton Miller, who was one of the early people at the early Tavistock, when it was actually at Tavistock Square, had helped me, because I was getting frightened in London Underground and tunnels and things of this kind, which is all in Freudian terms, I can see what it's all about.
Yes.
But he helped me then. I went back to him, and he said, well, look, if you want to go to leper colony, you really want to go away, and really think why you want to go and what you're doing. Well, to cut a long story short, I wanted to do something, and I decided... because of friends who'd had relatives in a private mental hospital, and I was so horrified at what I saw. Incidentally, one of the people I visited was Ivor Gurney down Stone near Dartford, who was a casualty of the First World War. I don't remember whether you know his songs and his poems, but and he was in Stone for, in a private hospital with what was called schizophrenia for many years. Oh, it was a combination of that. I decided that I wanted to do something about this, and I went and worked and trained in a private mental hospital, Camberwell House. Camberwell House, it was then. Of course, it doesn't exist now. And I trained there and took the necessary exams. And I finally ended up at Runwall in about, must have been 2 years before war, which was the last, I think the last mental hospital ever built. I don't know if you've been to one, what have you?
No, no.
It was built on the villa system. It's quite different from the ordinary barracks of the place.
Yes.
It was run by a very extraordinary guy, a psychiatrist, a Norwegian called Strom Olsen. And I was soon in charge of the admission ward there, and I was there doing the very early part of the blitz on London and so on. Of course, we were in the Thames Estuary, but it was pretty hefty going on there. Anyway, it was down during this time, just been about second year of the war, third year of the war, when Margaret had finished her medical training, because she only didn't want to become a doctor, she wanted to become a psychiatrist.
Yes.
And she came to Rumble on the what was called the emergency hospital service as a surgical registrar, and then came over to the mental side because that's what she wanted to do, and that's how we met. And that was one of the most bizarre goings on I've ever had, but I mean that's quite irrelevant from this point of view. But it was that sort of background. But prior to that, I had when I first came to London, because I got to the point when I couldn't go on my father any longer, and about 18 or so I came to London, and then I've always had the facility of getting to know in contact with people feel drawn towards. And one of the first people I got to know was Tom Armstrong, who became head of the Royal Academy of Music.
Yes.
And I played piano at that time fairly well. And had also with the Slade Professor of Fine Art at Oxford, Gledow, who introduced me to all the English 17th century watercolours and things like that. And it was getting in contact with various people of this kind that I really sort of, this was my education in a way.
Yeah.
Yes, right. I had an enormous amount of music and so on and so forth. And I had a miserable time working with a big textile firm called Moores in the city. Then I was most unhappy there. But anyway, put all that together, and I finally ended up in mental nursing. And then, of course, then there were, in the war, there was a reserved occupation. And I could only get out of Rumble, which I had to, because I couldn't stand going on. By applying for a job that was slightly senior to what I had. You were allowed to do that.
Yes.
And it was at this point that York Clinic was going to be, York Clinic was going to be opened at this point. So Strom Olsen introduced me to Gillespie, the great RD.
Yeah.
And I went up to London and met him at York Clinic. And he spent, you mustn't put this on, but he spent most of the time talking about his depression.
Yeah.
Literally. And he finally died at York Clinic under rather dreadful circumstances. Anyway, that was the background, more or less, before I came into social work. Now, after a bit at the Institute, this research wasn't going to get off the ground then.
Can I just pick up one other thing? Were you working for the New Education Fellowship before you were, right? Before you
Yes, indeed, yes.
What was the New Education Fellowship?
What is it?
Yeah.
Well, that, once we said, it was a group of people long before the war, it was after the First World War, during the Weimar Republic.
Mm.
That'll take you back some years.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were some of the leading educators in the world who believed in progressive education.
Yes.
They were very influenced by people like A.S. Neal and Montessori and all these people, And Margaret, of course, later on, she edited their journal, New Era, for them. Yes.
Oh, I see. That's
so we've been, she and I have both been connected with the NEF for years.
Yes.
And what we were saying, how... Oh, you were asking about the NEF?
Yes.
Yes. Well, you see, I couldn't leave. I wasn't allowed by the government then to leave York Clinic, but I did persuade them to let me do half-time.
Mm.
So it was a kind of compromise.
Yes.
So then I went half-time to NEF
Yes.
and started this International Book Club for them. and half time I worked at your clinic. And then when the order for what was that act called?
Essential Works or whatever.
Yeah, something of that sort. When that was rescinded,
yes.
Then I gave the whole thing.
Yes.
I'd done my stint, yes. I felt.
So was the NEF, can I ask you, because you mentioned earlier also about being a music critic for Tribune and so on, but the ideas that represented by the NEF and the sort of things that led you into wanting into psychiatric nursing and sort of your connection, you obviously got radical political connections if you're writing for Tribune, is that kind of sum up the kind of rationale or...
Well, I will tell you that if you haven't discovered, because many of these very old and I think wonderful PSWs were communists.
Yes.
They weren't just radical. Right. But so I wasn't a communist, but I was very left wing.
Yes.
And always had been.
Yes.
And a friend of ours was writing for Tribune and friendly with Orwell, who was a literary editor yes. then, and George Orwell. And somebody else, Fife, I've forgotten his name now, he was on Tribune. And she suggested that I would write weekly musical articles for them.
Yes.
That's how I came to do that. It was a kind of, I was working half time, looking after Aidan half time, and I wanted a bit more money, apart from anything
yes.
else.
Right. Yes.
And also, of course, I had umpteen concerts for
yes.
three.
Yes.
So that was a sort of nice combination of circumstances. But yes, that was more or less the background before
yes.
I went into. And what I'm really trying to say is that apart from actual nursing, I had a whole series of interests and experiences and knowledge that,
yes.
as well. You know, it wasn't
yes.
just.
I suppose the reason why I'm asking you, because I think what it draws out is, if you like, the way in which kind of personal, intimate experiences and the sort of the conclusions one draws from them, the political and philosophical conclusions that one draws sort of led you into doing the job you eventually ended up doing.
Oh yes, yes, and I think NEF was very important here, you see, because the NEF published, under the auspices of the New Era, all those articles during the war that Winnicott, Clare, she was there, Clare Britton,
yes.
and Winnicott wrote about the evacuation
yes.
of children, which also
yes.
interests you, and
yes.
Emmanuel Miller
yes.
and Anna Freud.
Yes.
We've still got all those articles, by the way.
Yes.
And they were all published in New Era.
Yes.
So in a way, it was a sort of hubbub of psychoanalytical thought.
Yes.
And this, what I consider the modern and progressive attitude toward education, especially
yes.
the upbringing of children.
Yes.
And I can still remember Emmanuel talking to a small group of us in seminar about small children, very small children, and describing his son, who was then aged about 14 months, who is now is Jonathan Miller,
yes.
who was always opening cupboards and looking in drawers because there was a new baby just around, you see.
Yes.
And
yes.
Emmanuel used this as a
yes.
kind of description. But so that plus Margaret's work, and so many of the people we knew, the contacts we had with people like Kate Friedlander and Ruth Thomas and Reyes Freudian analysts and people, and it was that was the sort of world.
Yes.
I think.
And it's interesting in the way it sounds anyway, that people didn't have the same difficulty then in sort of bringing together the personal and the political that you often meet in present thought. People tend to polarise, and they are, I suppose by the end of the period we're going to be talking about, people were, Barbara Wootton and Audrey Harvey, what they did was actually polarise the personal and the political.
And
hold those two together from the start.
Yes, I think the question of polarisation has always been with us, people.
Mm.
But it always seems, the view, personal view I've always taken, apart from teasing people, I've always teased it, my Jungian colleagues,
yeah.
you know, just. But my view is that you take a general, broad view. There is no one answer, in other words, anything but.
Yes.
It so happened that Freudian theory helped me in my work and suited me.
Yes.
But I think this is a question of personality.
Yes.
I can quite see why people like Elizabeth Howard, for instance, was attracted to Jung.
Yes.
By Honeybun was an out and out Kleinian. Yes, this is as much personality as anything else.
Well, I was thinking that how you see, what I'm picking up from you is that you see a continuity between sort of ideas about the individual development and what we do with our children, how we bring them up, and what kind of political system we end up with.
Well, I'll put it this way. Aidan said to me the other day, I'm always grateful I was brought up in a moral household. Well, that coming from Aidan, I'm speechless, and it takes a lot of me speechless. Anyway, I got out of him really what he meant. What he meant was, both he, his mother and me, we treated every person, no matter what, who they were, what they were, in their own, we respect them as an in their own right as an individual, and that is really the basis of. So the question of politics, the question of psychology, if you like, the question of how you bring up children, how you educate, is all to me a part of the process. In other words, respect for the individual. In fact, I was very idealistic when I went to Campbell House because I was determined to make the lot, if I could, of the average mental hospital patient in those days much better than it was. I soon realised that you can't do anything like that until you've got authority. And so I had to wait until I'd got my exams, had a position of authority, then I could do it. And I can. One of the things that I feel, I think, justifiably proud about is that I did, in fact, especially at Rumbaw, do what I want, that sort of thing, what I wanted to do.
Can you tell me any stories about that? Confuse it a bit far back in time.
Well, even in Campbell House, this, I think, this period of time, you might find it very difficult to believe. I mean, these people were paying in those days up to about £20 a week, which was a lot of money in those days. And sometimes they were shut up all day, illegally. And they used to employ people as nurses or attendants who had been in the army, and you know, that was their institutional life. Well, bit by bit, because a few youngsters joined the staff, and but them and me can burn, we were able to show that you could handle patients in quite a different way. And that got through in some way. The other old gang went. And we used to open the doors and let these patients out, and they, as human beings, again, coming back to my point about values and me. I know this sounds almost like fiction. Well, we can call it that if you like, but it was true. And at Runwell, of course, you can understand sometimes people hitting out. You know, if a patient gives you a sudden blow in the jaw or an eye, you can understand. I mean, it shouldn't happen, but you can understand how people do. That's a different thing from a kind of attitude, you know, they're ill and I'm sane, and, you know, they're just patients, you know, that kind of attitude.
Yes.
And of course, in those days, they were what were called rate-aided patients.
Yes.
There were some private patients at Rumbaw, and I always got them, unfortunately, because Tommy sent them to me. And very often they were drug or alcoholic addicts who were doctors. And I remember saying to Tommy one day, what's the matter with all you doctors, you know? But that was how it was. But yes, I was able to really put into effect what I felt very strongly about this. And if I had felt it, if I had done nothing else, at least I'd done that. And that's not sort of blow my own trumpet, it really. And Margaret would, or anybody who knew me, would bear that out. And of course, being left wing, if you like, nothing I enjoyed more than fighting the nursing and administrative establishment.
Yes.
Which I did, and partly out of sheer naughtiness, and partly out of that. On the patient's behalf, not so much on my own behalf. I mean, I liked my own way, and I thought, well, my way was the best way, but that's my sort of weakness, if you like. But at least I fought on four patients.
Yes.
And particularly this question of suicide. In those days, the patients were put on what's called suicidal precaution cards. And some nurse used to stand
suicide at precaution
cards, yes. So the nurse had to stand over them all the time, and I had to sign the card and all that sort of thing, you see. Well, I stopped this on my ward, took great risks, but I held then and still would hold that if you have the kind of relationship you can have, even with a schizophrenic, and I'm not talking about verbal relationships, you can hold a situation without all this kind of, and of course it's been proved over and over again, but in the, but it was very, and it was very difficult because you've got to deal with the anxieties of the staff, because they get anxious.
Yes.
And you know, this is all rather exciting in a way. And matter of fact, a lot of this had a lot of related very much to psychosocial work in the long run. If you know, if you add these things together, they do make sense.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And in the same way that progressive attitudes in education and so on.
Yes.
Anyway, to get back to the Maudsley. Yes, this research into tics, I think it was really only Aubrey's way of getting me there. He had to produce something to the committee to appoint me.
Yeah.
And he never got off the ground, and I eventually became full-time at the Maudsley. This, of course, is by the way, but I, being a university appointment, I was, what is this superannuation, the University's Federation or something
like that?
Yes, that's right, yes. And so when I went over to the hospital, the National Health Service then, was. They wanted me to change over, and I said I wouldn't. And we had a ludicrous correspondence, went on. And the final letter, I said, I wish to stay as, keep things as they are, and I never heard any more. Well, luckily, it was a letter I did, because I went to LSE eventually, and it was all right. Then at the Maudsley, it wasn't long before they wanted to, the dean, Dr. Davis, the dean, wanted to start a alcoholic addict unit, which didn't exist in those days. This was, must have been 1950. And so, you had in a place like the Maudsley, I think, various units, and the professorial unit meant this unit was under Professor Lewis.
Yes.
And so I was in that unit, and the dean, of course, was part of it. So that he and I started this alcoholic setup. And we worked together, built it up bit by bit. Registrars came in because it was a teaching hospital. And the first article I wrote was for Case Conference on the Wives of Alcoholics.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
A lot of it I go back on now, but I mean, I think in terms of the peer when it was written. Now that had a far-reaching effect on social work.
Yes.
I don't know whether you know this.
I know the article.
Ah, yes. Well, you see, it rose for the first time, it rose the question of collusion.
Yes.
And when I looked through all the American literature, social work literature, and there was no other then, practically none, there was, in the whole index, never showed the word collusion at all. Well, it may have called it something else, but it certainly didn't show that. And I remember it took a long time, I think it took about 2 years, for me to be able to persuade the dean that the wife of an alcoholic wasn't some poor person being terribly treated by her husband. That a marriage is a two-way, relationships are two-way things. They're just as involved in their ways as the alcoholic himself. But you see, being you know, a very humane psychiatrist, he would see this alcoholic, and the kind of, the wife would describe the kind of life that he lived and given her, and so on. You could understand how these things, And when I eventually wrote up at some length, the early days of the journals emanated from talks by PSWs at our association meetings. Now there's a history to this, which I mentioned to you when we were up at Allison's. Noel Honeybun, Betty Irwin, I know whether Betty's talked about this, Betty Irwin, and a Miss Eaney, who went to Liverpool, may still be there for what I know, in the children's hospital there, and I met at Honeybun's flat. Because we were tired of the kind of meetings we had, which were addressed by doctors and various people. Because you must remember then, the profession, APSW, was mostly female, there were hardly any males, and therefore it was quite common for quite outstanding PSWs who were everlastingly talking about their psychiatrist, like they might be talking about their father, you know? We, as a group, felt that there was so much experience and so much knowledge amongst PSWs that we ought to be able to read papers and meetings and so on. And this, somewhere around this period, Tilda Goldberg got involved, and she suggested that one thing we should concentrate on, which was a very popular thing at that time, was what were called inner and outer needs. And the first paper we set off was Miss Lacour, who was a PSW at the Walthamstow Child Guidance Clinic, and she read a paper on the inner needs, I think it was, of the patient. And I really talked about the outer needs, if you like. In other words, what Dr. Bowlby in the Tavistock transcribed as countertransference, which it was, of course. You know, that I did find myself up against jealousy and other things that, you know, which one usually... And so there was a combination of this paper on a case conference, it was very early days of case conference, on the family of alcoholics. And I think the important issue there was really this question of collusion. Because it became... eventually it became accepted and understood, and finally made too much of, but still that is what always happens. But
How did you get onto that?
Well, you couldn't work, you see, you can't work with wives of an alcoholic or family of alcoholics without, I mean, I suddenly began to realise that, I mean, I knew that many psychiatrists had said, well, we've treated this chap, we've got him off alcohol, he goes home, his wife, and things go wrong, and his wife gets at him or something, and he's back on. And I began to ask myself why, of course. And I realised, as you will see from the articles I've written, that the real crucial difficulty is after the argument, they would call him, the patient stops drinking. Because prior to that, the wife had to take control of the whole family situation.
Yes.
She couldn't rely upon an income, she couldn't rely upon the children being brought up properly, and she really had to be both parents and run the whole setup. And once you've done that, it's very difficult to release slacken the reins. And never being quite certain whether your husband would start drinking again, because you've gone through that so often. And in an interesting way, the Alcoholics Anonymous knew this quite clearly. They used to talk about the honeymoon period.
Yes.
Are you familiar with these terms?
I was taught by you.
Oh, I see. So you know about it. Yes.
Yeah, but I want to hear you talk about how it all came to you.
Yes. Alcoholics Anonymous, they realised that things went wrong so often when... a man stopped drinking, either through the help of AA, else through medical intervention or something or other, or it might be Salvation Army for that matter. And then his wife would go through a very difficult period. She couldn't let him stand on his own feet, make decisions and so on. In other words, be proper father and husband. It was difficult, very difficult for her. And I have, I've got some newspaper cuttings, believe it or not. I never thought much of journalists. They got hold of this article of mine in the case conference. and distorted it. Mm-hmm. So there was a sort of large headline, don't waste your sympathies on the wives of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. Edgar Myers and Morty said so and so and so and so. I never said anything of the sort. Mm-hmm. But that's the way they interpreted
yes.
it.
Yes.
Where was I now?
Well, you're saying how you couldn't work with...
Oh yes, yes, I assume, yes, and it's brought home to me.
Mm.
And then I sort of realised that in my work and my colleagues' work, we all collude.
Yes.
And it was never kidding ourselves, we don't. Mm. And the only thing I could ask for, as I suggest, was that we got were more aware of it, as aware of it as we could be.
Mm.
It's like any form of transference.
Yes.
And I'm sure when I look round at the amount of energy and time that psychiatrists and social workers have used because they failed to see that they're colluding.
Yes.
So that it was, I thought and still think it was quite a valuable concept.
Yeah, I mean, it was a conceptual breakthrough.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that was acknowledged by quite a number of people at the time. But it was always remarkable to me that with all the Freudian theory and knowledge and the analytical knowledge that the American social workers had in those days, why this never somehow arose. It's really very rather odd when you come to think of it.
Yes.
But I suppose really that in any situation, that all these kind of situations, there are blind spots or places.
Well, I don't know whether earlier you were talking about somebody set you to reading sociology and so on.
Oh, that was Aubrey Lewis. Yes.
I wondered whether you'd read any Mead, or I don't mean Margaret Mead.
No.
I mean George Mead. You
know, yes, you've got to go back. You've got to go back in time. This was 1949. Yes. I don't remember. I remember a number of American sociologists I was reading. Of course, the Mannheims, they
yes.
were part of it. Both the the criminologists used to lecture to the mental health course when I was a student.
Yes.
The worst lecture I think I've ever heard in my life. I believe he's worse than Attlee, but saying a lot. Cardinal, what does that mean? Called Cardinal, an American sociologist? Cardinal.
Cardinal.
The first letter was K.
K. I can't remember.
No.
I've never heard that.
No. Anyway, I was reading a lot of sociology, which a lot of it bored me to tears. Yes.
No, I wondered whether, you know, when you talked about collusion and the there being a process, whether, you know, this guy George Mead has had in the 60s and the 70s, suddenly was rediscovered.
Oh, I see, yes.
I mean, you know, the whole thing about symbolic interactionism.
Ah. Oh, yes, the bell's ringing,
role.
yes.
So I wondered whether,
yes.
you know, you were... Whether
I don't think at the time I did, no,
analysis
no, no.
Analysis. Because, I mean, those articles were very... there were two articles, weren't there, in Case Conference about alcoholics and their families?
Yes.
Which were kind of like years ahead of their time.
Until that time, no one had got an addiction unit.
Mm.
Therefore,
yes.
there hadn't been a concentration in this.
But it antedates the FDB, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And Glatt, of course, he followed up finally. But
with that notion of marriage.
Yes.
And,
when I said that alcohol, I was at the second meeting ever of the Alcoholics Anonymous in this country.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
They'd only just formed,
yes.
and they invited me there, and the meeting was held in the boardroom of the London Medical Association,
yes.
and the members were barristers and doctors.
Yes.
It was many, many years before there was a group in the East End of London.
Yeah.
And of course at the Maudsley, all our patients and clientele were middle class professional people, very often
yes.
civil servants.
Yes.
And all the work I did with alcoholics at Moores, I don't think more than three, perhaps four were working men.
Mm.
because there were social reasons for this.
Yes.
And I suspect I've said that to you in the past, so we've been talking about it. But, yes, so that I always feel that I was really in the, well, as I say, I was the second meeting ever of AA, yes. And but I always felt I had to go to the pub after their meetings to drink. I remember Elizabeth House, I took Elizabeth House once along with a young, very nice young registrar from the mortuary. Mm. And went for a meeting. As we came out, she said Elizabeth saying, telling this story afterwards, the first thing Edgar said, oh, come on, let's go to the pub and have a drink for God's sake. Well, anyway, let's get back to business. Where were we?
Well, you started telling me about the Case Comments articles and how you got onto the idea of collusion and the...
This is connected with this meeting in Honeybun's flat,
yes,
too.
Yes, and then you said there was a meeting.
The
54 of the articles were in. They're in the first...
Yes, the inner, what we call inner and outer needs, yes.
When did inner and outer needs come out? What date was that?
Well, you must have, I assume, you have the collection of the APHW journals, haven't you?
Yeah, and I've got a reprint with me of that article, but I'm not...
I can't remember the date now.
In relation to the article about alcohol, which came first?
Oh, the Case Conference came first.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and then...
Then I wrote a long article, well, a longish article, a paper that I read,
yes,
at one of these early meetings, yeah, these newly constituted meetings, mm, at AAPSW.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Really, it's mostly about an alcoholic,
yes,
but there were other things too. But...
like a cadre of sort of half a dozen of you who are pressing for the APSW to run meetings at which you present.
Well, when I read my papers, mm-hmm, and Miss Lecoeur, this the beginning of this.
Yes.
And then there was a whole series of.
Yes.
And of course, what it did, it fed the journal.
Yes.
Prior to that, as far as the journal was concerned, I didn't like it because it was a little grey journal about that,
yes,
big,
I've got,
yeah, and which I used to call the Quakers journal. And in a way, the grey and the size of it, mm-hmm, had a kind of symbolic representation of PSWs. Well, yes, it did. It did. It, yeah, did, Alan.
Yeah.
For instance, it wasn't really quite nice to talk about, mm-hmm, salaries.
Yes,
mind you, many of these superb old PSWs had private incomes, but be that as it may, and they were probably communists at the same time, but I mean, that's how it was. But I don't know how this came about, but I was introduced to Robert McDougall.
Yes.
When I had met Kay because, mm, I knew, you know, she was, she interviewed me. And he was prepared to print, mm, the journal, and also when we lived in...
He printed the journal too, did he? He printed the APSW journal as well as...
In the early days,
did
yes,
he?
Yes.
Oh, oh.
And I felt the format, the whole thing, yes, had to be, yeah, much more professional,
yes,
not apologise for itself, that's how I,
yes,
saw the early one. And there was everybody swears a marvellous piece of work called Margaret Ashdown in those days,
yes,
who was, as far as I was concerned, was a kind of religion. It reminded me recently of this American economist chap, Milton Friedman. Mm-hmm. And I remember the head of Courtauld saying, well, you can't argue, this is a religion, you can't argue with a religion. Well, I felt like that about, mm, Margaret Ashdown, and I've upset many PSWs. I was all for the Honeybun of this world, who called a spade, and I,
yes,
couldn't stand all this kind of repressed aggression and so on. It's not for nothing that Margaret Ashdown was absolutely crippled with the rheumatoid arthritis. It was very painful.
Mm.
Well, I quite agree you can go too far with psychological interpretations of physical illnesses, but that's, mm, one wonders at, mm, all,
yes,
a person who can't,
yes,
be free with their aggression, really what happens to them, anything.
Yes.
I could never take Margaret at all, but as I say, religion's not my line.
Mm-hmm.
But she had a wonderful command of English.
Mm.
her reading in English literature and her knowledge of English literature and her writing and understanding of English was superb. And so that she edited in these early. Now, round about this period I'm talking, and I can't remember her name now, there was a PSW down at Portsmouth in St. James's Hospital. I don't know whether Reese, I believe her name was, but I'm not certain about that. Now, the medical superintendent at, this is before 1959, remember, before the Mental Health and Human Health Act, Beaton, Dr. Beaton, he had created a Beaton Empire in Portsmouth, so that the, Dr. Beaton created a Beaton Empire in Portsmouth.
Oh, yes.
So he was not only a medical superintendent, it was in those days, of St. James's, but he was also in charge of the Child Guidance Clinic and what community, psychiatric community work was done in Portsmouth and then. It was all under Beaton, so to speak. And this PSW wrote an article which was published in the journal, our journal, because she felt that a PSW should be able to take a patient on an order to hospital. Now, this really did send the balloon up in many PSW quarters, because you didn't do things like that. Your relationship, so forth, and so on, and so forth. Now, simultaneously, Tilda Goldberg was studying records, medical records, at the Maudsley. I discovered her down in the records office there one day, and she said, I've discovered a case of alcoholic, young alcoholic of yours, can I make use of the material? She did. And it was the case where he had no mother, this boy. He was what we would call a charming psychopath, really.
Yes.
And his father was very ineffectual, and I discovered he wasn't taking his antabuse, and so I insisted on him taking it then and there, his father there. And it was out of this, which upset many PSWs, that Betty Irvin wrote her famous paper, I still think, about the importance of probation work, because if we just...